tonight on Arena. Jerry Rothwell on his heartbreaking film, The Reason I Jump. And Gavin Quinn and Eugene O'Brien of Pan Pan Theatre Company and their new production, Mespel in the Dark. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A groundbreaking new immersive film, The Reason I Jump, aims to show what it is like to live in the world as a person with autism. The documentary feature from Jerry Rothwell uses sound and vision to create a cinematic world similar to the one inhabited by many people on the autism spectrum. The film takes as its starting point a remarkable book, also called The Reason I Jump, from the Japanese author Naoki Higashida, who wrote about his experience as a non-speaking person with autism. Naoki's words are the glue that hold together this film, which is an intimate portrait of five young people and their families and how they make their way through the modern world, which so often misunderstands and underestimates them. Delighted to be joined this evening by Jerry Rothwell. The book is an extraordinary starting point here, really, Jerry, and I think you came across this through the parents of Josh, who's one of the people that you focus on in the film. His parents, Nick Deere and Stevie Lee, read The Reason I Jump, had a profound impact on their understanding of how Joss sees the world. But the achievement of that book is an extraordinary thing in and of itself.
That's right. I mean, it's a 12-year-old boy, non-speaking, autistic boy in a suburb in Tokyo, who I think is getting to that age that a lot of us get to, where we kind of realize that how the world sees us is maybe not quite how we are. And the book is really answering a set of questions that he thinks neurotypical people have about his autism. He's non-speaking. He experiences the world in an incredibly sensory way, and it's this very poetic kind of sort of detailed sensory world he evokes through the book was written by pointing to letters on a letterboard. So it's painstakingly created, and it has that kind of exactness about it. But yeah, it's a phenomenal piece of work.
And then the translation that Joss's parents, Nick and Stevie, read, and I presume that you read as well, then was the translation co-translated by David Mitchell, who himself has a son with autism. So there's a great sense of a community coming to an understanding here through this book.
Yeah, I think there is a community built around the book. You know, in the film, what we tried to do was to, for the first sort of step I took really was to go and talk to Naoki about the project, you know, which he was excited about, but didn't want to be in or filmed or have anything that was kind of smacked of a biopic, which to begin with felt very difficult because that was obviously perhaps our way into this subject matter. But I think in the end kind of gave for a much more interesting film, because we were forced to kind of look at how do these words that Naoki wrote when he was 12, he's now 26, resonate around the world with different people and families.
So we do hear the words of the book, the translation of the book. How did you go about giving those to us in voiceover?
So I worked with a young autistic actor, Jordan O'Donoghue, and I guess the way I thought about it was as though now it was Naoki now kind of reflecting on his childhood. I mean, a lot of the book has its own kind of journey in it. I mean, it's 58 questions and answers, so in some ways not necessarily a promising start for an adaptation. There's no plot, there's no characters. But what it does is take you from a state of mind where Naoki is almost wondering why he was born to a state where he's kind of celebrating who he is and celebrating his autism.
I want to listen to a clip then that features Jordan's voice. The words of Naoki, obviously, here, but the voice of Jordan O'Donoghue, as you said, the autistic actor. And it's from early on in the film and early on in the book, one of those early experiences of Naoki Higashida.
So, how do I see the world? You may be looking at the exact same thing as me, but how I perceive it appears to be different. When you see an object, it seems you see it as an entire thing first, and only afterwards do its details follow on. But for me, the details jump straight out first of all. And then gradually, detail by detail, the whole image floats up into focus.
And that's the actor Jordan O'Donovan there with the words of Naoki Higashida from his book The Reason I Jump, which is also the title of the film directed by Jerry Rothwell, who's speaking to me about it this evening. So we have that aural representation of Naoki. You also have a physical representation of him on screen, Jerry.
Yeah, I think it was important not to feel that the young people, the young autistic people we kind of visit in the film, there's four sets of contributors to the film in different countries around the world, not to kind of think of them as sort of case studies of the things that Naoki says. You know, I was really keen not to give this sense, not to generalize, not to say, you know, there is something called the autistic experience, because as you see in the film, all of those people are radically different from each other. And so I wanted to kind of create a space for the book, which made us perhaps think about the young boy who'd written it separately from the contributors we come to in the film. And again, worked with a young autistic actor, Jim Fujiwara, who's a young Japanese non-speaking autistic boy in the UK, and it kind of constructed with him a sort of journey through a set of landscapes. So it's almost like the journey of the book, I suppose, a journey which could be seen as, you know, a journey from, you know, day to night, or a journey from the coast to the city, or or a journey home. But that really was a way of just trying to keep a sense that this book had come from a very specific person.
And then the other stories, the stories of those that you told then, the story of Joss, as I mentioned, this son of Nick Deere and Stevie Lee. Joss, I think, is one of the first of the people that we meet. Then the next person that we meet is Amrit. What is her story?
So Amrit lives on the edge of Delhi in India, in a kind of one of the big high-rise estates that are in the Delhi suburbs. And she is also nonverbal. She started at a very young age kind of drawing. And drawing, I think, at that age of 4 or 5 or 6, was a way of communicating to her parents her day, you know, the things that she'd seen, the experiences that she'd had. She's now 23, and in the intervening period, this kind of work has grown into this prolific sort of artwork, very detailed, huge, colorful canvases of people. And it felt to me she was a great way kind of into that different way of seeing that Naoki talks about sort of seeing detail before you see context.
Again, Naoki's book seems to have been such an important moment for all of the parents involved here. This is Amrit's mother, Aarti, speaking about the impact that reading The Reason I Jumped, the book, had on her and how she understood her daughter.
She used to have these obsessions. My fear was that it is socially awkward, and I would try and stop her from doing that. But when I read Naoki's book, I realized what she must be going through. So it's difficult. Yes, I'm sorry. I've acted so strange with my own child. I don't know how I fit into her mother's role. I've tried to stop her from being herself.
And that is Aarti, the mother of Amrit, one of the subjects of the film The Reason I Jump, one of the stories that is told by Jerry Rothwell in that film. And that is a perfect example, Jerry, of many moments during the telling of the various stories when it's deeply moving about the bind and the difficulty that parents find themselves in, full of love and love expressed in both ways, not necessarily verbally, but clearly very difficult situations for all involved.
Yeah, I think that there is that kind of layer of the sort of parental and the families in which people are growing up. I mean, I really hope that the film also, in the end, kind of sets you in the shoes of the young autistic people themselves, and tries to, you know, I think often we speak about non-speaking autistic people entirely through their parents' experiences, and parents have their own journey with an autistic child, and it's a very powerful and dramatic journey often, and one in which they learn an enormous amount, but it's not necessarily the journey of the autistic child.
Absolutely, and I guess it feeds into that old BBC series, Does He Take Sugar? You know, that
exactly.
And particularly in this case where you have young people who are non-speaking, the presumption that, well, let's get somebody else to speak for them is often used. And in fact, that is the case with Emma and Ben. This is a beautiful story, Emma and Ben, two families that live near each other in Arlington, isn't it, in Virginia, in the United States of America. And and one of those parents speaks at one stage about saying, oh, well, we just started to speak. I think it's Ben's mum says, we just started to say, oh, Ben said this and Ben said that, but Ben hadn't said a single word. But it was just presumed then that they would speak for Ben. They articulate that very well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then there's this kind of moment in the family's life where they start working with the speech therapist, who looks at how can you take the kind of fine motors of movements of speech, which are very difficult for some autistic people, and kind of put them into the gross motor movements of spelling. And what we see is this kind of amazing moment, really, where Ben, who has a kind of extremely articulate language, he's deeply knowledgeable about the world and about himself, starts to speak through the letter board.
Yeah, let's listen to that moment, actually. Emma and Ben, friends, really close friends, were doing some schoolwork together, and it's Emma's mother who's teaching them, and she's using spelling boards with them.
They've never been able to do this before. I mean, this is the first time they've ever had any access to curriculum. Emma, what was education like before you had these classes to go to? T-H-E-Y-W-A-S-T-E-D-T-I. M-E. They wasted time.
Let's go to eyes.
Okay, Ben, how do you feel? T-H-E-D-T-I-M-E. They've denied our civil rights.
I'm sorry, mommy. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You can't put it more clearly than that, can you? Ben is sounding out there. They have denied our civil rights. That's a clip from The Reason I Jump. Emma and Ben, two young people with autism, who communicate absolutely and totally by using spelling boards to communicate their thoughts. And as you said, Jerry Rothwell, director of The Reason I Jump, it's the intellectual rigor and the intellectual quality of Ben's statements that are so noticeable.
Yeah, I mean, Ben is someone who spends a lot of his life watching CNN. He's incredibly informed about the world. I actually shot a sequence where I think his mum and him were talking about who the Democratic presidential candidate should be, and his mum was all for I can't remember. I think he was going like, "Yeah, it'll be Biden and Harris," which was great. So I think as neurotypical people, we tend to judge people so much by speech, by what they say, by their eloquence, and that's seen as a kind of indicator of intelligence.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's clearly not.
I want to finish up because I can't not mention the nature of the sound in the film itself. It is totally immersive, and it's suggested that you listen with headphones on if you're listening on a small screen, and I guess in a big cinema with surround speakers would be the best way to hear this. I want to play the clip around the green box, and this is a story around Joss. So you might finish by telling us, if you would, Jerry, a little bit about Joss and these green boxes and how sound is realised in the film.
I think that so we decided to make the film in 360-degree sound, which enables you to kind of position the sound in a cinema in one of 128 positions. So you can kind of move sound and create focuses which perhaps not just the sort of in front of you sound experience. And worked with sound designer Nick Ryan and the mixer Ben Baird to record. We recorded 360-degree sounds in every location we shot in, and sort of built this soundscape out of that. And Joss is someone, one of the things that he finds, I think, really calming and enjoys is listening to the sounds, which to a lot of us, perhaps we can't even hear, of the green electricity junction boxes that you often see on the corner of streets. I've actually got a friend who also, who's not autistic, who also really enjoys doing that, who has very sensitive ears, and says to me that it's to do with the three-phase electricity and the way that the electricity phases into this pattern. In this sequence, we kind of take that idea and I guess give it a kind of subjective spin that the box, you know, with a composer, our composer, Manisa Desai, who kind of turns the boxes into a kind of choir.
We'll finish up by listening to that. But lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Jerry. Thank you very much for being with us and congratulations on a very thought-provoking and moving film, The Reason I Jump. And we'll finish with Joss and his green boxes.
Is it like a black Hoover?
No, it's like a red Hoover.
Sounds like a red Hoover. Does it sound like a black Hoover?
Does it sound like a black?
No, it sounds like a red Hoover.
Do you want to go now?
Green boxes have become a massive part of our life because we realise that Joss can hear them from a long, long, long way away.
So the immersive experience goes on in the film The Reason I Jump. Director Jerry Rothwell speaking to us earlier, and that was Joss and his mum and dad that you heard speaking about the green boxes from the film. And The Reason I Jump opens at the Irish Film Institute this Friday, June the 18th. You can find out full details on ifi.ie. Pan Pan Theatre Company have chosen to make a series of films for their latest production. It's called Mespel in the Dark. The four films will be streamed online from tonight through until June the 20th. Mespel in the Dark, written by Eugene O'Brien, directed by Gavin Quinn, but the stories represented in the films are inspired by the actors and creatives living in the Grand Canal Dublin 2 area. Delighted to be joined this evening by Eugene and Gavin. I suppose really what we're getting here in some ways, Gavin, is an insight into the lives of a group of, should I refer to them as bohemians? Is that acceptable? Certainly creative and artistic people who want to make art, but, you know, doing that when you don't have much money to kind of survive is part of the challenge, isn't it?
That's exactly it, yeah. So these seven or eight characters you see who all live in the same flat complex, they all have to do things to make that world work. To chase their dreams, to continue being actors and artists in the city can be quite difficult. So you follow their kind of, you know, their aloneness, their loneliness that's transmitted into the five films, and you kind of observe these uneasy individuals and just go about what they have to do to continue being an artist.
In the first of the episodes that I saw today, you have a character called Aidan. Aidan is an accomplished actor and a very successful voiceover artist as well. How on earth did you come up with the idea of casting Andrew Bennett, a very successful actor and accomplished voiceover artist, in that part?
I have no idea. It just came to me once while I was having a dream. So we interviewed all of the actors initially to get a handle on what their lives were like, and to try and figure out how we could make the character quite close to them for real, but also then to kind of make a fictional version. Mm. So that was part of the idea, to show that side of Andrew.
And I guess that's where you come in to a certain extent, Eugene O'Brien, the writer of the pieces. Did you basically get Andrew and the others involved in the various stories into a corner and say, right, give me your story and find the bits that you thought then would work in a more fictional landscape?
Yeah, that's kind of what happened. I mean, we did a kind of workshop before Christmas with some of the actors, and we kind of discussed various things with them, and then it was kind of more of a one-on-one thing with them where they told me various things about their lives and I cherry-picked what I thought might be fun and weird or strange, and I started to write these kind of weird little pieces. But I suppose you do that with all the writing you do, you know. All writing's based on the world around you, so you take bits and you make up other bits.
And did you make up the bit about the spice that Aidan finds himself going around shops and houses and neighbours looking for?
Yes. Well, I did indeed. That is, Andrew Bennett is not obsessed with this weird galangal or whatever it's called, the spice. So I made that up. It was the quest, you know.
Yeah, the quest was what interested you.
Yes.
Well, let's listen to Andrew Bennett as Aidan here, showing his eccentricity in many ways through his search for this wonderful spice.
I mean, my God, the only thing keeping us together is our child.
Arthur.
Little Arthur.
Pardon, that's totally and absolutely the wrong clip. Here it is.
Galangal? Never heard of it.
It's like ginger or turmeric, but it isn't.
They won't do? No?
No, they won't do. They just won't do. There is a delicate sweetness to the galangal. The whole thing depends on it.
That's Andrew Bennett as he had been searching for the galangal. I think he's in an Asian shop at that point in time when he's searching for it, Eugene.
Yes.
But to what extent, I know that in a previous Pan Pan production, Andrew Bennett's flat in the King Lear, or the Lear production, in fact, Andrew Bennett's flat was reproduced on stage. So to what extent are many of the things that we see happening in Andrew's flat here, in fact, a direct representation of nights you have spent in and around that flat and the fun that might have been had post-productions or whatever?
Well, yes. Well, I've been in his flat quite a few times, and it usually involved kind of playing darts and singing. But yeah, this man, of course, is not like those gatherings, because this man is a very lonely man. Mm. And this man is very trying to control his life and trying to and if anything kind of gets in the way of his little kind of mouse run during the day, it kind of really puts him off, it upsets him. And it's this kind of illusion of control I was interested in as well, that we all think we can control our day and we all think we can control our lives, but of course we can't. That's kind of, if the pandemic has shown us anything, is that we have no control over anything. So I think that's part of the thing I was interested in. And it's a thing I think I was also interested in, is when you live alone, and I lived alone up until recently for about 7 years, and you do have a lot of time to ponder things, and you do crave kind of your own way of doing things. Do you know what I mean?
That loneliness and isolation is there in several of the stories, but it's a different, it's a funny type of isolation that we get in the case of the couple, if you like.
Yes.
Tadhg Murphy and Anna Shields McNamee, and a baby called Ryan. And I believe Tadhg and Anna have a baby. Is he Ryan or Rain?
The baby's called Rain.
Rain,
the character's called Rory.
And the character's called Rory. Yeah. But Rain plays the character of Rory.
So this is the peculiarity of when you have aloneness, I suppose, in the case of a couple. In the film, you see that he's left alone in the flat. She comes home from doing a corporate gig. But you do actually see how perhaps this couple at the beginning, it starts off quite playful. And then towards the end of perhaps the relationship, or sometime into the relationship, money rears its head, and you see how, you know, people can separate. So you do see this sort of them living in their, you see a voyeuristic view into them being separately in their flat, and then you get that sense of their, separation and kind of estrangement as well. So it is peculiar.
And the other thing about that is, Eugene, I think this aspect that both two people working in a similar industry are in essentially the same sector, and this doesn't just apply to the arts, this is right across the board, there's a kind of a tension in that.
Absolutely. There is a good thing, because you kind of can understand what the other person's going through and the ups and downs and disappointments. But also there is a slight competitive tension in everything. And, you know, your best friend gets the money to make the film from the film board and you go, that's great. But, you know, part of you deep inside is dying. But, but, you know, there is that element of it. So I think there is that tension between this couple. And there's a lack of trust creeping into them because of the pressure they're under. to kind of make a living, which certainly wasn't there when I was that kind of age in the 90s. We, you know, four of us lived in a flat. The rent was very little. You got by on rent allowance and you did your profit share shows, and it was a much easier life, actually.
And I guess there wasn't a baby in sitting on the bed that had to be dealt with as well, as the couple have to deal with that particular aspect.
No, we had no babies.
Mm. Episode 3, we meet the architect, or I suppose I should say ex-architect, Francis Flood. I think we've all met a Francis Flood in our day. A way of communicating that it might best be described as a rant. I don't know where the idea for this came up with. One of his rants, Francis does not spare the feelings of some people, some of whom, in fact, work very, very near to where I sit at this very moment.
What building, made of steel and glass, integrity, grace, simplicity in a woodland setting, complete with central concrete core, sunken garden, contains one of Ireland's finest collections of art, and yet spews out a constant, never-ending stream of absolute torturous drivel. Anyone? Correct. RTE, radio building. 1971, Ronnie Tallon, Scott Tallon Walker. It was a symbol of a new national pride, a hope for a brave future, a place perhaps at last for Ireland on this stage of modern art and culture. Mm-hmm. Well, needless to say, gone is the sylvan setting. Up for sale is the collection of art. Sotheby's, Christie's, fucking eBay. And we see the rise of the gougers. The great cultural demise. Ireland sells its arse for a fiver.
There you go. That's Francis Flood. Gavin Quinn, you're sitting in the central core of said building as we speak. Eugene O'Brien, you are down beside the sunken garden. Explain yourself, first of all, Gavin Quinn, and for heaven's sake, no torturous drivel, please.
Well, we've all met people like that. Francis Flood, I guess, is a character. He's sort of stuck in time. He's somebody who might have been successful a good while ago, and through probably his own personality, his own faults, or who knows what, he couldn't get along with people, has been stuck in that flat, giving out and ranting. And now he decides he wants to write a book called Null and Void, giving out about the destruction of Dublin. So he is that sort of cranky artist, I guess, architect, what I would call like middle-aged fury. And he's going to rant on everybody.
Yeah, so grumpy old man.
Grumpy old man, yes, yeah. So obviously you don't have to like the characters you direct or write. And he's part of our culture, I guess.
He is indeed that. But how often have writers made characters the mouthpiece of things that they want to say, Eugene O'Brien?
I want to make this very clear.
The character made me do it, is it?
The character just wrote itself.
Oh,
no.
I see.
Many times the character does things that you don't agree with, or it does things, and I have a great fondness for this building and RT Radio, genuinely. This man is a kind of a monster, and he's lost. He's very, very, very lost. And it was also kind of a very collaborative piece with the actor, Ned Dennehy.
I was going to say, we should say at this point that is not a man called Francis Flood. It is Ned Dennehy, the actor, doing a very good version of a ranter called Francis Flood.
Yes, indeed. And Ned was an architect in a former life. So that was kind of where we got the kind of idea for that.
Yeah.
And even some of the things he talks about, it's an argument about architecture that's almost 15, 20 years old. So he's kind of stuck in that sort of vein.
Yes.
And it's just that person who just is always going to give out.
even if the building was knocked down and rebuilt, he'd still be given out.
Of course. Absolutely. He would.
And if all the presenters and all the content was changed totally, he'd still be given out.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
He just has that sort of, that rage and fury. Can't help it.
Yeah. And the other thing, just one other thing that I wanted to ask you about was the 360 aspect, because we have the various episodes. What's the 360 aspect of this?
So there's a 360 version of episode 1. It's a longer episode. It's 25 minutes. Mm. And that's on Sunday the 20th. And so it's filmed with a special 360 camera that has six lenses. So in other words, in like the first episode, you see Andrew's flat, but you see everything. and then you can use your arrows or your mouse to move around the apartment. So basically you see everything.
Yeah.
And so in this version, it's kind of interactive and you're able to watch it then, you know, on Vimeo. But you'll be able to actually almost be the editor and decide to look at to look at Aidan's books or to look at his clothes or have a look at his, if his bed's made, and you can look into his fridge. And so the idea then is that you really get a sense of the voyeurism is really, really exaggerated then, and you really get a sense of these kind of vulnerable.
Well, that certainly humans. Will be a great way to see all of it in that way and have a little bit of agency in the process as
exactly.
well for the viewer. Eugene O'Brien and Gavin Quinn there speaking to me about Mespel in the Dark, exploring the lives of 8 actors and artists. It will be presented as 4 15-minute episodes over 4 nights, 16th through to the 19th of June, online, with a bonus showing of episode 1 then shot in 360 degrees. That will be available on the 20th of June. Mespel in the Dark is part of the Brightening Air Festival. Also includes work by Kush Kim, who are presenting dance works from handball alleys around the country. And that's called In the Magic Hour. Lots of stuff to check out for sure on the website, which is brighteningair.com. Sharon Horgan and James McAvoy played an unnamed warring couple with a young son in Together, a new film made for the BBC. Essentially, it's a two-hander set in their London house during the COVID crisis over the course of a year. Top-notch cast matched by their collaborators Dennis Kelly, award-winning writer of Pulling and Utopia, and Stephen Daldry, director of The Crown, Billy Elliot and many other award-winning films. Mary McGill has been watching Together for us. I'll speak to her in a moment. But before that, let's hear a scene from very early on which gives you the nature of the dynamic between this couple played by Sharon Horgan and James McAvoy.
I mean, my God, the only thing keeping us together is our child.
Arthur.
Little Artie.
His name's Arthur.
Yeah, if it wasn't for little Artie, we would have split up years ago.
The truth is, we just
don't
can't
like
stand
each other.
So, this lockdown, being in the same house together, me
you
and
know,
him.
The only thing that makes living with her even remotely bearable is knowing that I get to leave this house every day.
I feel exactly the same.
Oh my God, saying goodbye to you, it's without doubt, it's the best part of my day.
Just being in the same room as him.
And coming back and having to see her again, I mean,
it's like a sadness and a soul stink both mixed together.
I hate your face.
My face?
I hate your face.
Oh, you hate my face?
It's just your face. I hate it.
Oh, what? So you're saying I'm unattractive then?
No, no, you're attractive. I mean, she's very attractive. It's just your face. I totally hate it.
I actually think of him as a cancer.
I hate looking at it. It's maybe your eyes or something.
Not skin or a testicle, but one of the really bad ones, you know, like liver, pancreatic.
Is it your cheeks? I mean, I can't even put my finger on it.
It's colorectal. That, when I think about you, I get exactly the same feeling as when I think about my dead dad's cancer. Exactly the same.
Sharon Horgan and James McAvoy in a scene there from Together. And that scene, by the way, is set on the 24th of March 2020, day one of lockdown one in the UK. Mary McGill, as I said, has been watching this film for us. If that's what they're like on day one, they have quite a way to go, Mary.
Oh, yes. It all sounds like it's going to go incredibly well, as you can gather from this clip. Yeah, lockdown is literally the worst thing, Sean, that could have ever happened to this couple. We just heard there they looked forward to saying goodbye to each other each day. But of course, that has been thrown into complete and utter disarray. And so the pressure that the relationship was already under, you know, holding it together for their son, is now up against a once in a lifetime historical event that they think, you know, initially is a bit of an inconvenience. But as we know, the audience watching this is they are in this for the long haul.
Dennis Kelly and Sharon Horgan, they co-wrote the comedy Pulling in 2006. They're old friends. And that, again, there was a similar kind of dynamic in some ways between a couple. It was slightly different, but there was that couple dynamic was very much at the heart of it. Very funny was Pulling. If you're looking for belly laughs, I think Together is not the place to be going.
Yes. Now, there are zingers and there are moments that are very funny.
Yeah.
And initially, you are in very familiar territory, or at least that's what it feels like if you're a fan of Sharon Horgan, if you've watched Catastrophe, of course, Pulling as well with Dennis Kelly, who does a great job here writing this. If you have watched, you know, The Brilliant Motherland, we're in the London suburb, Sean, we're used to these zingers, you know, and this kind of dark comedy that they're very good at. This is not that. We are entering a space where there is a lot of anger. there is a lot of grief and there is a lot of bewilderment. And the sense that I got watching it was, and I wonder if this is going to be a kind of a theme that, that comes through in COVID dramas and more generally, is you're watching the characters go through this and it begins to dawn on you. You're like, we've all gone through this.
Yeah.
And some people have really gone through this. And just now, as we're emerging from it, there is this sense of it's only kind of now that we're beginning to process what has happened over the last 18 months. And that's certainly the experience I had with Together. And this is very much about a couple going through that processing in real time themselves. It throws up all kinds of questions, you know, they thought they had problems. Well, my God, do they have problems now? And of course, that again is a kind of a tension that many people will be familiar with over the last year.
But we see at times just little flashes of perhaps what was the attraction and what was a kind of tenderness between the two of them, or at least a caring about each other in some ways. We get little flashes of that. I haven't seen all of it, but I'm dying to see the rest of it because I've only seen the early parts of this particular film. They talk directly to camera, which initially really got me, you know, took me by surprise. Looking directly out at us in that scene that we just played, in fact, they're speaking to the camera, or i.e. speaking directly to us, the viewer.
Yes, and they do monologues as well. And the entire drama is really set in the ground floor of a middle class house. So it's quite, obviously, it's very contained being a pandemic drama. We couldn't do much over the last year. But part of that is the nature, the way Dennis Kelly wrote it, because he wasn't sure as he was writing it what he was going, what it was going to be. He sought advice from, you know, people like Stephen Daltrey and Sonia Freeman, who were involved in the eventual television adaptation. But they toyed with the idea for a while of it being a play, settled on going for a film. But I could totally see how this would transfer to the stage as well, because it does have that feel. The monologues would work brilliantly well. And it is, it's quite claustrophobic on screen, I have to say. And I wonder if that would feel more expansive on a stage. I think it might. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if it makes the leap to the stage in the next, we'll say, couple of years. It would work really well, I think.
Yeah, well, something that made the leap the other way from the stage to the screen, of course, was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And I mean,
indeed.
And the fact, it's very much like, it's like a modern day version of that in many ways. And in the film, you can go outside, you can go to other places, but in COVID, you can't really, but In a play version, you have the claustrophobia of one set. They don't go anywhere. They can't go anywhere.
No, they can't. And I think that's a great example, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Because watching that film, like watching Together, is a visceral experience. You see a couple who know each other and on some level have a fierce tenderness towards each other and a fierce hatred towards each other as well. Absolutely tear each other apart and become the worst version of themselves.
Yeah.
And yet still have the potential to become the best version of themselves. And it's such, I mean, there were, I think that example of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is just perfect, because sometimes it almost hurts to watch them tearing at each other.
Yeah, you just think, stop, leave each other alone. Yeah, you know.
Exactly. The cruelty of it, you know. And of course, in the pandemic, that's heightened even more because they literally only have each other.
Yeah.
But in a weird way, and this is something that Sharon Horgan is very good at as well in her own writing on, you know, romance, it is the muddling through and the making do and the realization that this is it, the two of them are it, for better or for worse, that strangely keeps them or draws them together.
Yeah, the one other stylistic aspect that I think is worth mentioning is the constant we hear news reports in the background, or in that scene that we first heard there, there's police sirens going everywhere because that day was kind of mad. Here in Ireland, the day for the first lockdown, there was all this craze, and of course Sharon Horgan's character's arriving in with enough toilet rolls to clean the bottoms of the entire suburb that she's living in, never mind her own.
Absolutely.
That kind of documentary style, what does that bring to it?
It brings a real sense of Sean, it's amazing how quickly we forget. I mean, the great toilet roll stockpile of March 2020, how could we have ever forgotten? And yet you see her pulling all these toilet rolls out of the boot of the car and you're like, oh yeah. And while she's doing this, the beats to the BBC breaking news theme is playing and you're like, oh yeah, that was a viral video. And everyone, every time you heard that, those beats, you were like, oh God, no, what is it now? And you know, they're having discussions and they're frustrated, she and he, these characters, because they're like, should we wear masks? Should we not? And you remember, oh yeah,
all the confusion around that. Yeah.
All the confusion. And they're wondering what to do with her elderly mother, who's their last remaining parent who's alive. How should they take care of her? And of course, you're like, oh my God. Like and this is the thing, you forget in very quickly on one level what the last year has been, and yet on another level we'll never forget.
Yes,
and
when I saw the toilet rolls, it brought all that back for sure. Go ahead.
It sure did. But I mean, one thing, and I think this is what it does really, really well, is underlines, I think, a lot of what has been, if you're lucky and have been okay and have managed to muddle through, maybe out of sight or a little bit hidden. As we go through this drama, it's punctuated every so often with the number of people who have passed away from COVID. And there is something about that, and it's quietly done, but it just builds up to this
point.
Kind of devastating. Mm. Yes, 100%. And I don't think we have begun to kind of process all
Absolutely.
Of that yet. So I think this is where drama comes in. I am indeed. Really well done.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's, for sure.
Sharon Horgan and James McAvoy in together. Miriam McGill is previewing it for us there. It goes out on BBC Two tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. Jonathan Lee, the British-born writer living in New York, one day came across a marble bench in Central Park dedicated to the father of Greater New York, Andrew Haskell Green. This turned into a 5-year research and writing journey and his latest novel, The Great Mistake, blending memoir and fiction. The book describes Green's formative years and evokes the dynamic transformation of New York in the latter part of the 19th century. As the father of Greater New York, Green helped shape the city's most iconic landmarks, including Central Park. But he is largely forgotten today. Joining me now to tell me more is Jonathan Lee. Bring me back to that moment, if you would, Jonathan, when you found this bench, and I think fairly immediately your novelistic mind was prodded into action.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't really set out to write about turn of the century New York City, and it came about because I have this sort of strange obsession with park benches. I love them and I seek them out wherever I go. And I like the sort of formal inscriptions, but also the penknife engravings and the graffiti and all that sort of stuff. And I was surprised to find, walking in Central Park one summer alongside Montaigne's Rivulet, which is one of New York's original streams, this bench dedicated to a guy called Andrew Haskell Green. I called him the father of Greater New York and creating genius of Central Park. And I got curious because I'd never heard of him before, and those were pretty big words. So I started looking into his life.
You started looking into his life and you didn't find loads of material out there. Given the sort of, give us a sense of the type of activities that he was involved in as a, I guess, essentially a civic leader, the sort of things that he helped make happen. And when you hear this, you say, how come there aren't thousands of books about this guy?
Yeah, it's amazing, really. I mean, once I started looking into him, I was slowly piecing together a few things. The first thing, the sort of headline thing that there was a lot of material on, was the fact that he was murdered on Park Avenue at the age of 83 in what was potentially a case of mistaken identity, which is part of the reason why my book is called The Great Mistake. But the bigger mistake, I think, is in being forgotten, because when I started to look into it, Central Park wouldn't really exist without him. He was not the designer of the park, but he was the person who came up with the idea of there being a middle park, he called it, before rebranding it as Central Park, and who put it into action. There would be no Metropolitan Museum of Art. He was one of the founders of that. There might be no New York Public Library, no Bronx Zoo, no merger of Manhattan with Brooklyn into a single city, even, because at that stage they were separate. And he brought about the Union, and that was another thing that gave the book its title, because the New York Times called it The Great Mistake of 1898.
So, I mean, as I say, extraordinary that then his name isn't on many biographies and that his life hasn't been told in many different ways, because in and of itself, I suppose, in some ways he has a very uninteresting life, and another way because he was quite a private man. So it was very difficult for you to get at the stories behind, you know, the privacy of what way his life was, apart from all his civic works. You came across material, though, that made that a lot easier.
I did, yeah. I ended up at the New York Historical Society, which has a great library, and a really brilliant librarian there helped me find these boxes of his diaries and letters that no one had really checked out for years on end, and blowing the dust off them was pretty thrilling.
And within that, I guess you found lots of the material that would then make its way into the book. What sort of family did he grow up in? I think his father in particular, you get this sense that the poor guy spent his most of his life, Andrew Haswell Green, that is, sort of disappointing his father.
I think that's exactly right. I think he, you know, he was one of nine and he grew up in this busy farm household. His father had sort of had money and had a sort of career ahead of him as a lawyer at some stage, and then some things had gone wrong. And by the time Andrew was born, it was a family that was in trouble and financial trouble, and kind of in terms of unhappiness within the family too. And you know, in the diaries and letters, you can feel that trouble coming through. And you can feel Andrew's sense of horror and failure when he's basically sent away from the family farm in Massachusetts to make money and be useful in New York at the age of 15. And he starts working at this as an apprentice at this general store. And his two loves are reading and walking, but he can't really afford to do either. The libraries are private and the pleasure gardens are ticketed spaces.
And to what extent,
kind of interesting to think about.
Yeah, to what extent do you think that, you know, that reality, the walking and reading being his great passions, he couldn't get books from the library because, as you say, they were private. Any public spaces weren't public. They were ticketed and you had to have money to get in there as well. Was that part of what really, you know, pushed his civic mindedness along?
I think it really was. It's so fascinating to think about that, isn't it? That if he'd had a different start in life, in the privacy of his own family and his own mind and his own existence, there might not be a New York Public Library and there might not be a Central Park, because he wanted those things to exist for the next generation of New Yorkers, whatever their background, who might arrive in the city, which is really fascinating. And of course, with the pandemic, we're rethinking public space as well.
Yeah. Also, this is a lovely little detail about how, in fact, he was integral to the formation of MoMA and getting all the great artworks that are there. He's quite a canny operator in many ways.
He was, yeah. I like this about him. He was sort of had a quiet but indomitable spirit, I think, and where a lot of the founders and people involved with setting up the Met were going around sort of appealing to rich patrons on the grounds of altruism. Andrew Haswell Green, the guy I'm writing about in The Great Mistake, sort of said to them, hey, this is your path to immortality. We're going to have your name under these paintings and it'll be a great way to show off your artworks and your reputation to your friends.
Yeah, clever, as you say. However, the book does start with this great mistake that is his murder. I know you won't want to tell us everything on this particular score, but we know pretty much who did it. So what were you looking for in terms of investigating that murder and the records around it?
I find it fascinating as a why done it rather than a who done it. And my last novel, High Dive, about the bombing of the Grand Hotel in 1984, was similar in this sense, because I think that people's motivations are the most fascinating things, and it's often not who did the crime that's the key question, but what conditions made it happen. And I actually thought at first that the murder investigation, which is really fascinating and is a thread through the book, would be basically the whole book, but I got more and more interested in the life that lay behind it. There's a good Virginia Woolf quote where she says in one of her diaries, I meant to write about death, but life came breaking in as usual.
Yeah. I'm trying to find Bessie's second name because she's kind of integral to the murder investigation and the life around it. Bessie, the madame.
Bessie Davis.
Davis,
yeah.
That's it.
Although
Bessie
she
Davis.
Had many names. Yeah. Yeah.
She's a wonderful character. And she is a real life character.
She is, yeah. She was fascinating to research. She became the center of the murder investigation after Green was shot dead on Park Avenue by a man who said he'd committed the killing because he was in love with Bessie. That love doesn't seem to have been reciprocated. But she was a black woman who was sort of pushed to the margins of society and since pushed to the margins of history too, who kind of came up from nothing, but she started running this uptown mansion that she said, in quotes, satisfied the needs of gentlemen of the highest sort. And a lot of New York's leading politicians came through her door, and she became one of the richest women in New York for a while.
Yeah, and the, I think certainly there's a suggestion in the book, whatever love might or whatever relationship might have existed with Bessie Davis. You mention a childhood friend of Davis, of Green's rather, and you also mention an interesting historical character again, Samuel Tilden, that the relationship between Green and those two, the young boy and the man later on, that there was possibly a romantic interest there?
Yeah, there was. I think that Andrew Haswell Green and Samuel Tilden, who was, you know, went on to be the governor of New York and was a presidential candidate too, they were the sort of central emotional relationship of one another's lives, and the diaries and letters really bring that out. You know, what they don't tell us is if on a physical level it went beyond being platonic, but certainly theirs is that they were there for each other, and it was a very complicated friendship and relationship. And I sort of tried to do justice in the book to the ups and downs of those relationships, because I think, you know, they were sort of obsessed with each other. They furthered each other's careers, but they were also the source of the greatest heartbreak for each other in a way.
Yeah, he is a fascinating character, and you kind of deal with the murder aspect of it. I'd love to hear even more about the kind of the way he went about achieving the things he did as a civic leader, but maybe that's for another book, if not from you, from somebody else. But thanks for speaking with us this evening, Jonathan.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Jonathan Lee, and Jonathan's book is called The Great Mistake, and it is published by Granta. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. John Meegan was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. Right now, however, time for John Creedon.